Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Welcome to episode 563 with my guest Daniel Carcillo. I am Paul Gilmartin. This is the Mental Illness Happy Hour, place for honesty about all the battles in our heads, from medically diagnosed conditions, past traumas, and sexual dysfunction, to everyday compulsive negative thinking. This show's not meant to be a substitute for, I don't know why I pronounce it, substitute for professional mental counseling. I'm not a therapist. It's not a doctor's office, more like a waiting room. The website for this show is metalpod.com. And if you're ever interested in a particular topic, just Google whatever keyword you're looking for and include the word metal pod. And that's the best way. I mean, you can do it at our website as well, but I just usually Google it. Let's dive into some surveys. With my cold. My cold is co-hosting today. I went and saw a concert last night with my girlfriend. We saw the Strokes at the LA Forum, and they were originally scheduled for March 20th, 2020. So it was worth the wait. It was an amazing concert. They're such a great band. So original. I think I'm getting old, though, because I really wanted to say to the band, does it need to be this loud? This is from the Struggle in a Sentence survey filled out by Onion Dillbread. And he writes about his anxiety. Thanks for the hand-me-down, Mom. About his alcoholism and drug addiction. My grandfather's addiction is the monster under my bed. And then a snapshot from his life. 3 years ago, when I started dating my fiance, I had a conversation with my mom telling her how excited I was to go on a trip with my new girlfriend in a few months. She replies, "Are you sure you'll still be together by then?" You know, that's all you had to describe, and we get a perfect picture of your mother. He writes, "Just for context, I've only had 3 girlfriends. It's easy to notice the toxic, quote, man whore ideology coming from a parent, but when you've had as little partners as me, I knew she was just projecting her issues onto me in a very confusing and degrading way. Even to this day, I cannot express excitement or prospects I have, or I will get that, 'Are you sure about that? I'm going to doubt the shit out of you,' kind of look. Growing up, my parents painted the picture of them being demigods, the perfect parents. They could do no wrong. As I age, I realize that they were almost always wrong. I feel bad saying all of this, but it feels like my support system, I believe to be so ironclad, is as feeble as a house of cards. P.S. They denied my ADHD and my anxiety my entire childhood, and I didn't get help until I was on my own. I see them taking care, I see them taking my little sister, who still lives with them, to therapy. Maybe I was the guinea pig and they learned from me? But that poor girl is a clone of my mom's mental illness, and I hope she can learn to grow and break free from those mental bonds she is subjected to in that house and find happiness. I feel so shitty finally saying all of this. Thank you for sharing that. And, I, you know, I just want to commend you on claiming your truth. And I don't know anybody, once they claim their truth, that feels 100% totally good about it, because there's usually some kind of guilt. We feel like we're throwing somebody under the bus. There's grief, there's sadness. But you have seen, you have gotten some clarity. And, you know, as they say, you stopped going to the hardware store for milk. You realized. I had a moment, too, where I realized in my relationship with my mom that there was like a joy kill aspect to her, where if I would be excited about something, she would, you know, find a way to poke a hole in it. Not always, but enough that I just, I would shut down around her. And that's a, that sucks, whether that's in a friend or a parent, but it just sucks to really not be able to share your joy with someone. And I wonder sometimes if the parent, you know, their intention is, oh, I don't want you to get overly excited and then be disappointed, so I'm going to protect you from that. Maybe that's what they're trying to do, but it is not good. And you can quote me on the record saying that's not good. If that needs to go to the Library of Congress, so be it. This is from the Love Survey filled out by Nellie. And Nellie writes, I love my best friend. She's taught me to open up and actually tell her how I'm feeling without fear of judgment. That is so awesome. That's winning the lottery. Having a friend or a family member or even somebody from your support group that you can feel that with, that's a lottery. This is from the Ask Paul Anything survey filled out by, I know I'm going to butcher this, Lapis Lazuli. please don't mock me. Would you be able to do a podcast on borderline personality disorder? I find that it can be very hard to navigate through the world with this disorder. I've listened to your old ones and I enjoyed them, but for some reason I've had a hard time connecting to that podcast. How people feel emotions wasn't explained as well as I thought. And I would really like to hear another perspective on what BPD looks like for some people. I agree with you. Not that I wasn't able to connect to those episodes, but that it's a really important topic, and people who struggle with borderline personality disorder, or as it's now called, emotional dysregulation disorder, they can feel really isolated and alone and ashamed. And yes, I will make an effort to try to have more guests on that that struggle with that. And thank you for weighing in. This is also from the Ask Paul Anything survey filled out by Ding Dong. Ooh, I love your snack cakes. And they write, why did you stop with the top 10 episodes? Because I'm lazy. I wish there was a better way to find episodes on Apple's podcast app. Yeah, it is not the best way to search for episodes. I would do the old Google and including MetalPod. Excuse me while I cough. This is also from the Ask Paul Anything survey. And Cinderella asks, by the way, how are your shoes fitting? I'm fully aware that you are not a licensed professional. You make that very obvious. So I'm not trying to get your professional advice. However, have you ever had to deal with a friend or family member that was suicidal? If so, how did you deal? My brother went to college across the country. He's my favorite person on earth, and I'm terrified I'm going to lose him to suicide. I researched what to do on those health websites, and there's no answer. I'm not expecting you to give me an answer either, don't worry, but do you have any experience? My dad made a suicide attempt when he was in his 60s. I would have been in the early to mid 90s, early 90s. And we attended some, he was forced to go to rehab. They wouldn't release him from the psychiatric unit unless he went directly to rehab. And we drove him to rehab on Christmas Eve, of course. And nobody talked about it in the car on the ride home. And yeah, we went to a couple of required family support group meetings at the rehab, and he never attempted it again. So I don't know if I could weigh in on having someone who is actively suicidal. But my opinion is, if you're not a mental health professional, you can give that person certainly love, but it's a serious thing that I believe needs serious professional help. Whether it's a suicide hotline, the rules in different states vary, but generally, somebody can only be involuntarily committed if they are deemed a danger to themselves or others. So the person in many ways has to want to get help. But what I would suggest is you getting help for yourself and the stress around that. And the National Alliance on Mental Illness is a great organization. It was created for the loved ones of people that battle mental illnesses. And I believe the national website is nami.org. So that might be a good place to start. But sending you some love. It can be a really isolating thing, being the loved one of someone who is suffering. And then we feel guilty because we're like, why am I feeling bad? I'm not the one who's suffering, but we are. We are suffering because we are helpless and we love that person. This is from the Ask Paul Anything survey. And, this is by the same person, Cinderella. Have you ever been to a psychic or a medium, and do you believe in ghosts? You know, I tend to think that most psychics or mediums are full of shit and are predatory. But I could be wrong. I'm certainly leaving the door open that I don't know. And as to whether or not I believe in ghosts, that I might believe. I might believe in that. I certainly believe in the movie Ghost. You've got to believe in that. Anybody that can make pottery so sexy, oh, man. This is an awfulsome moment filled out by Lisa. She writes, I recently connected with my spiritual team and ancestors. As awesome of that sound as that sounds, I also realized that they've witnessed every weird and horrible thing I've ever done in my life. Probably even watched me masturbate, which I've done a lot. And lot is in capitals. But that's okay. I know they love me and would never judge me. I assume that she did like a seance or something like that. I think everybody imagines that. What if dead people are watching me jerk off? Oh my God. But isn't that part of grandma's job? You bake cookies, you babysit the grandkids, and then you hover around the ceiling and you watch somebody go to town on themselves. And you try to reserve judgment. This is an awfulsome moment filled out. This is also by Cinderella. Cinderella, you're getting a little greedy with the surveys. And they share, I'm happy that my father has started to go to AA meetings again after a few years. He says that he's doing this for himself and that he needs to learn to love and take care of himself. I'm happy for him and proud. The only thing is, I wish he wanted to do it for me. And first of all, thank you for sharing that. That's such an important point to make. And as somebody who is recovering from alcoholism and drug addiction. I can tell you that it is almost impossible to get or stay sober if we're not doing it for ourselves. But here's the good news. The good news is if we begin to let our hearts soften, we begin to learn how to handle our emotions like an adult, we learn to be helpful to others and not so selfish and fear-based, then we can really truly begin to see the negative effect that we had had on other people and be happy that we're there now for those people and that we have different relationships for them. I hope that makes sense. We are sponsored this week, as always, by BetterHelp.com online therapy. They are licensed in all 50 states. I have tried several of their counselors. My counselor, Donna, actually, who is no longer with BetterHelp, so I'll be getting another counselor soon. She was awesome. She was awesome, and I tried a couple before her because I didn't want to get just one counselor and then just assume that all the rest of the counselors were like them. So I tried two or three before her, and they were all great. If you're interested in trying it out, go to betterhelp.com/mental. Make sure you include the /mental part so they know you came from the podcast. And then fill out a questionnaire. And based on your questionnaire, if they have a counselor that they feel is a good fit for you, they will match you up with one, and you can get 10% off your first month of counseling, and you need to be over 18. If you're not 18, they will direct you to teencounseling.com, and then you can get the ball rolling on that.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So, what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
And then finally, this is an awfulsome moment filled out by Joe's Pizza. He writes, I had a cycling accident bad enough that I cracked a helmet. The new one I bought has speakers built in. I was out on a ride and stopped at a street crossing as you were reading surveys. I don't remember which episode it was, but the survey kept saying pussy. I had my helmet on full blast while there were two families with young children hearing you say pussy over and over again. One of the children asked their dad what that meant. As the light went green, I took off laughing, feeling bad for that dad.
I just wanted to get the fuck away from my life.
You know, I couldn't have felt any lower.
Grief, guilt, shame.
Why wasn't I born a girl?
There's a switch that gets flipped in my head.
I'm supposed to be a girl.
I experience being treated like an animal.
How can a just God...
I have a vomit fetish.
...let humans do this to each other?
Help!
I fucking flew over the cuckoo's nest.
My wife's losing it.
I thought it was all about me.
I don't know what to do.
I would have committed suicide if I could have watched my funeral.
A Polaroid I found of my mother, naked in a dentist chair.
And my body doesn't quite...
I think I did 8 days in L.A. County Jail.
...fit how I see myself.
What was it all for? Why are my friends dead?
Everything that I did...
There's a comfort in the scars for me.
...was in service of OCD.
You've already had all the paper cuts. Step away from the paper.
It's really hard to see the picture when you're inside the frame.
You know, it takes a larger view to see your life.
Just actually have somebody listen to you.
Yeah. And I got up and got my tooth and left.
I'm here with Daniel Carcillo, who is an ex-NHL player, mental health advocate, concussion sufferer. Where are you at today, man? How you feeling? I know depression is kind of something that fucks with you from time to time, or is it always kind of there?
No, it definitely wasn't always there. I obviously spent a lot of time over my life hitting my head, both concussive and subconcussive. So I think over time it evolved into this combination of just being in an extremely toxic culture and then obviously getting hit in the head and the body every day doesn't bode well for symptoms. And eventually it just caught up to me. You know, it started to catch up to me. The first time I felt any type of anxiety or depression was when I was 25 in my career and I really had to make a choice. I leaned on numbing it out with opiates and things that were easily accessible rather than looking at it and dealing with it. And then it resurfaced again later in my career. And I just have spent the last 7 years trying to get a handle on my quality of life and my brain health. And, you know, you asked at the beginning of the question, like how I'm feeling. And number one, I'm not getting it hit in the head or the body right anymore. And so the things that I'm doing seem to be having this cumulative effect where I am by far the best, healthiest, happiest, most connected version of myself for sure.
Well, that's great to hear, man. I see in the news a lot, people that it takes them down. Steve Monitor was a good friend of yours. And talk about CTE and Steve.
Yeah. So right along those same lines, Steve was able to come into my life at a time where I was really searching for somebody to show me how to live a happy, fulfilling, sober lifestyle. And that came at the perfect moment, you know, his support. And since he'd been on that journey for 7 or 8 years, when I got to Chicago and we became teammates, it was easy to go to meetings with him. It was easy to integrate into life without substances, which can be extremely different for people and difficult, but he showed me how to live that happy, fulfilling life and really helped bring out a lot of confidence in myself. You know, one thing that I was attracted to Steve about was just the way that he carried himself, you know, the way that he spoke in every conversation, how comfortable he was everywhere. And
attraction rather than promotion.
Yeah. Just there was something about him. Right. And I think we see that. I'm sure people see that, right. They see something that draws them to somebody that they just want to know more. That was how our friendship started really. And then blossomed over the next 3-4 years into, just, a lot of dialogue about like what's next, you know, especially that last year when I saw him go through 4 concussions in 12 weeks and get cleared and everything that happened with the Blackhawks is a difficult time. But we were searching for what we were going to do next. And I think that it was, you know, something that was weighing on us and important for us to figure out together. And I think that was my son. You want to say hi?
Hello.
Hello.
I think that, so, you know, we connected on a personal level, and then we went through the same struggles together on the brain injury side, and that strengthened our friendship. But it was, one of the most difficult things that I've had to watch, and be a part of is somebody's deterioration after contracting neurodegenerative disease, which is progressive. And right now we don't know how to stop that. I think we have some ideas of how to possibly prevent and minimize, but not to the level that Steve got to, because Steve, you know, was cleared for 19 concussions in a professional hockey league that
19.
Says that,
wow.
That says that they don't have any issues or that the issue isn't repetitive head trauma. And so what I proposed to the NHL, being the only league left on earth to not admit a link between repetitive head trauma and neurodegenerative disease like CTE, like ALS, like dementia, is, you know, has there ever been a case of CTE found in somebody without a history of repetitive head trauma? And there hasn't. So just like you can't definitive, they just use the same narrative as smoking and cancer, right? That definitive link is yet to be established, but we know that smoking is bad, right? So hopefully with more research and more understanding and more pressure, to be quite honest, with litigation, that will change. And, you know, back to what I've learned from Steve, I mean, I've learned everything from that friendship, you know, and how to move forward now in a positive manner rather than what I was doing before I found my recovery. You know, it started about 2.5 years ago when I really started to turn the corner, when I started to use supplementation and live a holistic lifestyle. But I mean, before that, it was a journey that was lonely and difficult, and a lot of anger, frustration, sadness came out. And really now it's, you know, this medicine that I've used, it includes psychedelics, has really shifted my perspective of my injury, my world, the NHL, just everything. It's changed everything, right? And I think that's one of the keys to my recovery, to be honest with you.
It's really amazing what a prism mental illness can filter everything through, and addiction as well. It warps everything, and it's so hard to rely solely on the brain that got us in the place that we are, to get us out of the place where we are. And community and friendships and asking for help is so important. What did it, give me a sense of what your bottom was like with the substance abuse. Give me a snapshot or two of how ugly it got. And then, you know, the shell of defiance being cracked a little bit.
Yeah. At 25, so I was in the substance abuse program that the NHL has, after I got into trouble, at 21. And then at 25, just kind of living a really fast and ugly lifestyle, had fractured relationships with family, wanted nothing to do with people. I thought I was, you know, God's gift. And I mean, the role that I was playing, I was fighting people that were, you know, sometimes 40, 50 pounds heavier than me that could really do some damage. So it was easier for me at that time to live recklessly, both on and off the ice, and not think, right? So I used substances to numb and to be able to do that, because that's not who I am as a person. That's never been who I was. But this is a different, you step onto that ice, you're stepping into a different realm. I have different rules that I'm able to operate on. And I am able to hit you with this. I'm able to hit you with my stick. I was very unpredictable. And that stems from a lot of the trauma that I sustained in coming up in hockey as a minor.
You were given the name Car Bomb by your fellow players, correct?
Yeah. That came in Philly. And, you know, that was one of my weapons, though, was up until 25. Nobody knew what I would do, because I didn't know what I was going to do, to be quite honest with you. You know, there was a really, really bad year that shaped Daniel Carcillo into Car Bomb. And that's always how it happens. It's always stems from some type of traumatic event where then I'm all of a sudden acting totally different. Like, my friends don't really recognize me. My family doesn't recognize me over the years, as it progressively gets worse and weighs on me even more and more and more. And the way that I dealt with it was a lot of, you know, drinking. The opiates were just, at that time, you know, this, we're talking 2006, handing them out like chiclets, you know? And, so it was easy, to get access and really easy to live that lifestyle. But at 25, you know, it works until it doesn't work, you know, especially those substances. Right. And then all of a sudden I just started to crash. I started to fail. I started to play less. I started to get hurt more. you could just see the writing was on the wall that if I didn't change my lifestyle and my habits, I was not going to be an NHL player for very much longer. And I don't know if I'd still be here. It was, you know, got to that point. And then that's in my career, you know, then I cleaned up. I went to the Stanley Cup Finals my last five times. I asked for help, like you mentioned, right? I went to rehab on my own. I detoxed, all that stuff. And I woke up to who I really am. And then I was able to make, you know, bridge those gaps with my family and apologize for all the things I wanted to apologize for and really change. And then now all of a sudden, though, I'm like, oh boy, now I can't fight the same way. Now I can't play the game the same way because I'm actually awake to the damage I'm doing to myself, to others. How do I do this? How do I perform at this level and still be car bomb that every team still wants me to be? And so what you see in the last 5 years is just me trying to be a good teammate, walk that line a little bit more so to the right direction. And then I went to the Stanley Cup Finals, you know,
I'm from Chicago.
Four times.
Yeah.
Four times, but with three different teams, you know? And so, you know, that's like really important for me to always look back on and reiterate even to myself, because nobody's ever done that. And like, I changed who I was as a person. And so I think you get rewarded when you're living your life the right way. And, but then, you know, then things, it's like life, right? There's peaks and valleys. I mean, I hit another valley, right? Where it was retirement, forced retirement. It wasn't, you know, although I made the decision to walk away because I saw a lot of the same symptomology in myself that I saw in Steve. And then obviously Steve was found to have neurodegenerative disease and CTE. I was like, wow, well, I mean, I'm experiencing that now. I'm 30, 31. It scared the heck out of me. And so for 4 years, you know, from 2015 to 19, I looked, man, I spent $300,000. I did everything I could to manage symptomology and to look for treatments to manage. You know, we talk a lot about traumatic brain injury. It's TBI just related symptoms. The only issue with when you're dealing with post-concussion syndrome, I was dealing with slurred speech, headache, head pressure, insomnia, impulse control issues, memory issues, anxiety, depression, suicidal ideation, heightened cortisol levels, low free testosterone.
Other than that, you were okay.
Yeah. So like, it's just different. TBI is different. There's neurological with cell damage issues that you have to deal with. There's physiological that I mentioned, and then central nervous system problems. And so, I remember, you know, this was 2 years ago, 4 years into this journey, thinking I'd tried everything. So becoming pretty hopeless. And I was the guy who was trying to advocate for different things. Hey, go try this. This didn't work for me, but still go try this because it could work for you. Got to a point where I became extremely suicidal. The depression, the anxiety was just at an intensity that I didn't deal with anymore. And then I started to feel people tiptoeing around me. And that really, I looked at my kids. I have three young kids, 6, 4, and 3. And I was like, man, I know a lot of people view suicide as a selfish act, but it could be a selfish act to spare others. You know, that's the way that I was kind of viewing it, where it was like, let me take myself out of the equation so that my kids don't see how unstable I am emotionally. So that my kids could have a good life, so that, you know, and so I started to make plans to take my own life, over the course of the next like 3 or 4 weeks. And again, I don't know why this invite came, but the invite came to the farm to go learn, just about possibly one more thing that I didn't know about. And I'm just, thank gosh, I took that lifeline, because it saved my life. It was the most difficult thing I've ever had to surrender to, this psychedelic experience, but it saved my life.
And when you say the farm, what are you speaking about?
Just a farm, where, you know, you can learn about CBD, functional mushrooms, growing your own fruit, vegetables, living a holistic lifestyle, hiking, meditation, you know, these holistic interventions that you can make, including psychedelic medicines, that happened in a decriminalized city, you know, and so from that standpoint, other than going to unregulated Jamaica or something like that, the Netherlands, you know, I felt in a really safe environment with the right setting and dosage and the right guide. And like I said, it, you know, mental health, anxiety, depression to me were these loops that kept getting solidified stronger every single day that I lived in them. And what seemed to happen right away was, number one, when I took this medicine, being psilocybin, it showed me the hell that I was creating for myself. And so I had to live through that. It puts a mirror right in front of your face that you can't walk away from. And so people call that a bad trip. I call that saving my own life. Thank gosh, this medicine showed me that, because although being difficult, 2.5 hours of that, it showed me who the problem was. And then it also showed me how I could fix it, you know, and it all starts here with me. It doesn't start with anybody else. With me and the way that I view this world and my relationships and how I think and how I'm attentive to my own recovery. Am I prioritizing sleep, diet, these other things that have such a huge influence into how we operate? So I'm the type of person that likes a little punishment. I like to be uncomfortable, and I've been uncomfortable a lot in my life, right? And so these ceremonies really helped me break out of that mold and out of that loop. And so, and then we're seeing this in fMRIs, and we're seeing this, this being tracked and validated by science that it can wake up right and left brain hemispheres, and it can help break up those destructive thought patterns that are embedded. And then the amazing thing that can happen, if you have the right guide, it can be, and the right intention, which I did, I just wanted to recover my brain health. I just wanted to recover some semblance of myself. And it did that. This medicine did that for me. And on a spiritual level, it was unbelievable that a handful of mushrooms, given in the right context, in the right dosage, the right person with the right intention at the right time in my life, could do that to me. And I mean, that was 2.5 years ago, and it's, I am still amazed every time I tell the story, and I don't tell it much.
So you don't have to do it regularly. This was kind of a one-time thing for you.
A big dose. Yeah. I mean, I've been on a really strict regimen. That's what we're taking through the FDA clinical trials of high dose, psilocybin therapy, in combination with low dose. So microdosing, but that's in combination with other patented neuroprotectants, and then other adaptogens and other mushrooms, you know, that again, it's just a different type of therapy because of what I mentioned to you, the cascade of downstream sequelae that comes and symptomology that comes. So no, it's been a very poignanted regimen. There's months off, there's days off, there's been weeks off. Every single week you take time to take off, because then, you know, you don't build up a tolerance to this natural medicine, number one. And it gives you a chance to live life without it, which I think is extremely important. This is just one tool in my toolbox. This is not my crutch. This is just something to get kick-started.
You know? I'm glad you mentioned that, because for a lot of us who battle addiction and mental illness and other struggles, there is no one fix it. And almost none of it happens immediately. And it's just a daily routine that becomes the foundation of our living, as much as it might be a pain in the ass or inconvenient, especially when we're depressed. You know, when it's hard to get out of bed, the thought of going and exercising is just like, what? Why would I want to do that?
And I still have those days where I think like that, you know what I mean? Like that, but that to me, you know, I try to, I'm more present in my body. So I like recognize now what my triggers are. And if I do spend a day where I sleep in, which some people call depression, if you're saying that you're depressed that day, that's depression and I'm depressed or I'm not feeling it today is totally different to me. Right. And if it's not chronic, and then I can recognize that this is affecting my life, you know, just me recognizing that, that's enough, man. That's the issue that I have with, you know, like mental health as a whole, the way that we describe it, right? Because we think, I'm sure, you know, depression, when I was dealing with it, yeah, like I was in it, you know, and nobody could talk to me, you know, but I kept telling myself the fact that I was in it and that I know I'm in it is enough, because I was also searching. I was still actively trying to be proactive and get a handle on what was happening to me. So, you know, what we're trying to create, right? And what I'm trying to create, I'm not trying to be a life coach, and I'm not trying to be perfect, because I'm not. I still get stressed and I still yell and you know, but what I don't have is, like, I don't deal with these things on a regular basis anymore, right? I don't deal with impulse control. And yes, I still get sad, you know, I don't call it depression. I allow myself to feel sad, you know, and I feel different. I feel like what happened to me is the biggest blessing on earth. And I had to go through a lot. And I just think whoever my higher power is knows I can handle a lot. Mm-hmm. And so it threw a lot at me. And then now I you know, I think with the messaging, we just have to take it easy, you know, and like, it's little by little, little steps. And, hopefully this conversation, you know, somebody hears it and it helps them. And it sparks something. Like when I learn something new and I try to learn something new every day, like I get really excited, you know? So like that those juices are flowing and my frontal lobes are activated. And, you know, that's the exciting thing about this therapy is it has a lot of the same characteristics as just regular depression. And I think that it can, really shift perspective, you know, and once we do that, you know, with the right and left brain hemispheres communicating and really the anti-inflammatory benefits as well, I think are, you know, and then little to no liability and safety, a nice safety profile with no crippling side effects, it can be extremely, it can transform the way that we treat, you know, if people want to look at it. Like if you'd like to, so I read this analogy, which is really amazing. You know, we continue to manage symptoms. Same with TBI, right? Like I can't even research traumatic brain injury because nobody's done that work yet, because all we seem to want to do, the healthcare system, is manage, you know, let's just make it a little bit calmer for this person for the rest of their life. I'm not interested in selling people that. I'm interested in helping people that have depression look at their depression and figure out why that is taking over their life. Because if I can walk upstream and talk to people before they jump in, I want to keep pulling them out of the river, you know, downstream. Like, let's figure that out, because there is always some underlying reason. Right. And I think if people are willing to look at that, oh my gosh. I mean, the recovery that I've seen people have over the last 2.5 years in helping them, you know, it's been, if I could ever get addicted to something, it's that look on someone's face when they come out of it, you know.
The feeling of meaning and purpose in sharing our struggles with others, it's such a surprise. And to me, that's where, you know, the benevolent force in the universe, call it your higher power, God, whatever, that's where it exists. And when we're in that depressed place, we never imagine that the universe has good surprises for us. We just imagine it's all going downhill. It's going to be a shit show. And why not just bail now?
Man, like me and my wife have talked about this before. Like I used to just always recite that, like, I'm going to find something. I'm going to keep looking. I know I'm not that good right now, but I will figure this out. I will figure this out for survivors. First, selfishly, for myself. And I need to be selfish. You need to be selfish. Everybody needs to be selfish when it comes to their mental health, because without this and this, me embodying this energy now that I'm putting out, it would have kept going bad for me. And my wife couldn't support or be confident in that I was there to support her at all times and our kids. So I had to get healthy for me. So I had to get selfish and I had to figure that out, you know. And then, once I figured it out, it was always like I would recite it and sometimes I'd have the voice in my head saying, "What are you talking about, man? Like, look at you. You look like shit. You know, this is BS. And then I would say it again. I'm like, "No, you know, we're going to figure this out. You know, I'm going to figure this out. I'm going to find something and I'm going to be able to tell people about it." And for whatever reason, you know, that happened. But I really believe, and it's the same thing that I manifest now, like with our company. You know, I remember sitting 10 months ago being like, Mike Tyson would be an amazing strategic advisor for what we're trying to do for TBI and psychedelics. And I'm boom, like, talk about it. 5 weeks later, we had Mike Tyson as a strategic advisor. You know, all of the things that I've spoken into existence and that I've really wanted, I continue to speak about it. You could ask my wife. She tells me to shut up all the time, but I won't, you know, because any chance I get an opportunity to talk about it and put it out there, I know it's going to come back, you know? And, so that's what I mean, that's a simple thing that we can all do, is be defiant in the face of these voices. Like, we all, I think, have these internal conversations. Right. And that's also, I think, more normal than not. I know not a lot of people talk about it. But I really do believe, you know, we're the only ones who are on earth that can think about thinking. So, we are special and everybody is special. And I think that there's ways out. There's ways out of the darkness for everybody. We just have to, we got to keep talking about it. And I'm appreciative of platforms like yours, man.
Thank you. And that's where I think patience and gentleness with oneself are so important. You know, if the struggle of, managing addiction and depression over my lifetime has taught me anything, it's that it is not on my schedule when I get better, but I can choose to take a nap, to be gentle with myself. One of the things that's helped me is to look at depression as just a flu of my brain. You know, on any given day, I wouldn't beat myself up if I had the physical flu and, you know, wanted to cancel an appointment. And obviously it's different for every person. Some people can push through it. But others, like me, sometimes I just need to go, "Hey, today is just going to be a chill day."
Yeah, man. I mean, so when you think like that, do you go get a massage? Do you go like do something for Paul, you know, like, do you do that?
Yeah. Sometimes I do. Yeah. Phone calls are important.
Yeah.
And that phone feels so heavy on the days.
Yeah.
Because I'm sure, as you know, one of the symptoms of depression is a difficulty in describing it, which makes me even more depressed, or even knowing if I'm feeling depressed, because a lot of times I experience numbness, which to me brings in so many other secondary factors. You know, well, I'm not feeling sad. I'm not feeling angry. I don't want to cry. What am I complaining about? Maybe I'm just lazy. And, you know, that's the mantra that the mean part of my brain loves to latch onto. And it's taken me years to be able to say, you know what? I'm not feeling myself. I'm going to take baby steps today. You know, maybe I'll just walk around the block. I don't feel like working out. Mm. And that to me has been an important part, that self-love, because I think so many of us blame ourselves for having depression or anxiety. Mm-hmm. And that to me is just gasoline on the fire.
Yeah. Yeah. And to your point, it's what works for you, you know? My internal voice was always negative, but like, again, it's like, I needed that, man. I liked it, you know? And that's what kind of like got me going. And that's just because of my upbringing and being called, you know, every name in the book to get motivated by coaches, teammates, you know, just my upbringing. Right. And so, yeah.
Finish your thought, but I wanted to ask you about, you know, to go back to when you were a kid and an adolescent and questions about that. Did you have a thought you wanted to finish?
No, we can go back. Yeah, for sure.
Go ahead. I was going to ask you when you had the feeling that you might be able to make it to the NHL.
That was like, I don't know, 13, maybe 14 years old. I played AA my whole life. Everybody in Canada plays AAA, which is the highest tier. You don't necessarily get looked at in AA. So that 14 year, I made the jump to play AAA because I thought I had it. You know, things open up, right? Like there was one spot on the best team in the GTHL and we ended up winning everything and got a lot of eyes on me. The longer you play, higher you get drafted, and ended up, you know, working towards going to a lot of like OHL camps and then university visits. And at that age at 14, like I committed, you know, I was going to be a lawyer or and go to school and apply myself there or try this hockey thing. And I was never a kid that grew up watching, idolizing, thinking I was going to be an NHL player. I used it as like a good anger management tool, the game anyway. And that was really when I started to take it seriously. 15 rolls around, you know, you're a year out to either going to university or the OHL and you got to make a decision. And then I chose to go to the OHL route. And
which team did you play for? The Sting? Sarnia Sting?
Yeah, the Sting. And like I was and still am a very sensitive, introspective type of person and thinker. And you know, although most people know me for the toothless psycho that I was on the ice in Philly and beating people up, I'm opposite, total opposite off the ice. And that was shaped by, in large part, this trauma that I sustained. It should have been, you know, the best year of my life. But my draft year was one of the most difficult years of my life. I got drafted to the NHL, 72nd or 73rd overall, but endured a lot of sexual, physical, emotional abuse at the hands of teammates, coaches. It was, you know, there's a class action lawsuit going on now to make sure that something like this never happens again in the OHL, which is pretty prevalent, very well known. You know, like, what are you complaining about? That's just hazing. But again, it just not like, I think back to my journey through this life and what I've endured and then all of the successes, right? And then like, they all kind of even out to allow me to be in this position today to actually have people listen, you know, and then create instead of just talking, which is great. I'm still doing that. It's all about, you know, actually building, because you got to build on this side. And I'm getting visibility into like an industry of pharmaceutical drug development that is interesting, you know, I've, you know, been blessed to have been through it all. You know, I really do believe that, like, thank gosh that experience happened to me it's difficult. But man, that formed me into Car Bomb, who then, that's the reason I got all the concussions and then the anxiety and the depression. And then, you know, who I am as a person is somebody that always sticks up for people and myself. And, you know, that's just kind of what I'm trying to do now is bring, whether it's TBI related or not, it's just neurological, you know, neurological wellness, health, you know, the way that we think and then how that informs our experiences in life. And then, how we can, if we're not happy with it, shift that, you know, but like shift it quickly too. Cause for me, still today, right, I still have to be cognizant of the fact that I'm not, I could become depressed or I could experience depression again or anxiety, if I let things slide. And so when I see myself isolating, like if I have the thought today before this podcast, like, oh, I don't want to do this, but I'm going to do it anyway, cause I'm committed to it. I didn't have that thought, but if I did, I'd be like, what is that? You know, I immediately start questioning, what is that? And then if I start looking at other things, maybe it's something upstairs, maybe it's with my family, maybe it's, you know, something in the business that I'm not paying attention to, like, what is it? I start looking for it before it becomes, oh, well, now with the isolation, guess what? I'm not sleeping. Mm-hmm. And I'm staying up an hour past my bedtime. That's a problem for me as a TBI survivor. I need sleep. And then I'm also under eating, or maybe I'm overeating. Like, those are my three things, man. If I see those, any of those creep in any way, shape, or form, I know I have to look internally to figure out what the heck is going on at this point in time. This stuff doesn't just arise from nowhere, right? And so that's the process that I use now. This medication that I'm on, that we're developing, allows me to become the observer, and it really allows me to view, oh, hey, look, you're doing that again. Maybe there's someone you need to call. Maybe there's something you need to look at. Maybe there was an oversight. Maybe. So that's what I really love about this tool that I'm using. And I use it in conjunction with exercise, not every morning. I'm probably the heaviest I've ever been right now, but I'm okay saying it because that can be changed. You know, I'm not going to beat myself up about that. You know, so that's kind of, that's the lens that I take now. Right.
I'm curious about the mental strain or the routine, the pressure of coming up and finding that your role is a third or fourth line guy that's an agitator, where it's not your authentically who you are. Were you defined as a skill player when you were in juniors?
I scored 30 goals a year. Yeah. I got, you don't get drafted 72nd or I think it was 73rd overall in the best draft there ever was in the NHL. The most deep draft by being an enforcer. So I was both, right? Like, I played this game in junior. I only fought 5 times in 3 years. So I wasn't a fighter. But I ran through people. When you got hit by me, you knew it. And I also knew that from who I am and then how you have to act in the game, sometimes at the adult level, as I graduated to the AHL, you're going to have to fight, man, you know? And, I just learned it, you know, and I was okay with doing it because of that year that I had a lot of pent up anger. Yeah. So, and to be honest, like we spoke about before, I didn't care if I got hit, man. I didn't care, you know, and that's dangerous, you know, fighting somebody that can take hits and doesn't care, you know?
You wouldn't have pre-game anxiety about, oh, I got to pair off with so-and-so?
No, man, not those first 6 years. I couldn't wait to rip somebody's face off.
Oh, my God.
And it's still in me, you know, like that, like it's still in me, you know, but I just don't hit people anymore because there's different rules out here, but I hit different ways, right? With my mind, I problem solve, I beat people. I see things now in this business and what I'm doing and what I'm trying to create and changing healthcare. Like that's the way that I punch now. I'm not gonna highlight what's wrong with the NHL anymore. I'm gonna just create, and then they'll have to answer questions why a former NHL player is now the CEO of a company focusing solely on improving traumatic brain injury and care thereof, right? With the WBC, with Mike Tyson. So that's what I am solely focused on now. But a big part of me, do I wish that I could, you know, go and fight again? Some days, but I just do it a little bit differently now, you know.
Who was your least favorite person to square off against?
Well, the guys that I knew I was going to take some from. So I tried to stay away from guys that could end my life or break my jaw or my career. But there were a couple that I had to fight. Like Radius Ivanis is like 6'9", 280. I heard earlier that year he did like 17 one-arm pull-ups at training camp. So,
oh my God. And you are, what height and weight were you when you were playing?
I was listed at 6 foot, 210, but I was 5'10 and a half, 190, 195, soaking wet. Yeah. So him and then Darcy Hordichuk, big boys, you know, that could really hurt you.
Was there ever an overlap between you and Probert?
No. I mean, Bob was a really good player. Yeah. He was like a classic heavyweight, but he could also play. But I wasn't a heavyweight. I was this new class or new breed of a guy who could change the energy of a game with a hit, play on first, second line, move up and down. Not a classic traditional top six forward. Not in the NHL anyway, flashes and moments of it. But really, yeah, just somebody who could move up and down the lineup and do most things, you know, not a special teams guy, but yeah, that's how I kind of build myself. I could skate, I could hit, I could fight, I could shoot. I'm not the best at any of those, maybe fighting for sure. I was one of the best at my size. But yeah, that's kind of what I prided myself on how I modeled my game after those things, you know.
What did it feel like? It's such a fucking cliche question, but what did it feel like hoisting the Stanley Cup for the first time?
It was okay. It was, you know what? Like I get more joy out of like watching other people, you know. I'm a little bit different in the way that I would never got enamored by hockey. And it was probably because of that first year where it was like 1 foot in, 1 foot out, you know, let's try to make as much money as possible and get out with being as healthy as possible. I imagine that's a lot of guys' thought, or at least their second thought. And maybe their first thought is that they got brainwashed by Hockey Night in Canada and all these other things where it's like hockey's a family and it really is all about this 35-pound trophy. And once you win it, well, then you get, that's the culmination. All I need is, if I just get my name on this cup, I'm going to be happy forever.
Right.
You know, and it's not,
I have heard guys share that the next day they felt an emptiness because they were expecting something to fill them that it couldn't.
No, I mean, and the world keeps turning, you know, and really, I mean, I wouldn't put the NHL up with the top four sports anymore. You know, I think soccer's far and beyond surpassed them. So, I mean, if you don't live in Canada and you don't go home a lot, not a lot of people really see it, notice it. Listen, there were a lot of things going on in 2013 in respect to Steve and just a lot of things happening. So, and then I was angry because I wasn't playing. And so, you know, I was like, there was some part of me that just wondered why I was even there. And then, yeah, after winning, it was like, I was more happy that my bros were there and that like Taves won again and Kane, these guys who like love the game, like, and apply everything they have to it. You know, I was just a guy who was kind of like coming off the street, making playlists, enjoying it while I was there, not taking it too seriously, and also enjoying like my life away from the rink, you know, music, concerts, food, just, you know, art, everything that the city had to offer.
When you were playing, who were some players that you think were really underrated?
I don't know. I didn't really like study people. Mm-hmm. There were players that like took my breath away watching them, like Kaner and a couple other guys that are just that were really fun to watch from the bench, you know. But I couldn't put my finger on any like players that I thought were really underrated. Yeah.
Anything else you'd like to share before we wrap up? You have a foundation, Chapter Five, and what is the name of your company?
Yeah. So Chapter Five Foundation. And then WESANA Health. So
WESANA.
Yeah. Sauna is heal in Latin. And, We Heal is something that, you know, like you mentioned, just community building that support system around concussion survivors, ultimately mental illness and mental health survivors. And you can find us, you know, you can find our website, and we are researching through the FDA pathway and Health Canada pathway, alternative treatments, including technologies and psychedelic medicines like psilocybin, to treat TBI related anxiety and depression. So, yeah.
Well, thanks for being on the team and being a great advocate. And I'm glad we finally got a chance to talk.
Yeah, me too. Thank you for having me.
I always love getting to talk to NHL guys. I always feel like a little kid, even though they're younger than me. I'm just, I don't know. I'm glad we got to connect. Let's dive into some surveys. This is from the Shame and Secret survey filled out by a guy who calls himself Uncle Sam's misguided stepchild. He identifies as straight, but he qualifies saying, but I think I would go anyway if I found a deep enough love. He's in his 30s, raised in a slightly dysfunctional environment. Ever been the victim of sexual abuse? Some stuff happened, but I don't know if it counts. Acts with other children as a child, all unaware of what sex or sexual abuse was. He's been physically abused and emotionally abused. Getting the belt from my stepfather never seemed like a punishment. It felt like abuse and above and beyond any type of parenting seen as acceptable in the 80s. Emotional abuse was in the same manner between my stepfather and myself. Any positive experiences with the abusers? As adults, we genuinely get along, and as he is older now, I am sure he probably regrets it. Darkest thoughts. I'm comforted that I can leave this life anytime I want to. I often linger on suicidal plans and the relief death would offer. I think that's pretty common. You know, at least I know when I'm in that place where I just, everything feels overwhelming, there is a certain comfort in knowing that that's a possibility. And some people don't want to hear that. Some people are like, oh, you need to change your attitude, or you know, need to do this, or, you know, do that. Well, fuck off. Was that a little harsh? Darkest secrets. I fantasize about leaving my wife and children, house, success, and taking up a transient life on the streets, in dumpsters, living for drugs and alcohol. Living a half life of highs on heroin sounds better than a full life of depression, PTSD, and anxiety. Sexual fantasies most powerful to you. I often have fantasies of my wife cheating or having sex with other men. A huge insecurity, but I also wish she was more sexually active, even if it was with others. What, if anything, would you like to say to someone you haven't been able to? When I hear about other people committing suicide, I grieve, not because they are gone, but because they had the strength to do it, and I do not. Wow. I know that you are not alone in feeling that, and I hope you don't feel guilty. You know, feeling guilty about what we're feeling is such a waste of time and so unkind to ourselves. You know, for me, the thing to focus on is, in what way can I deal with this feeling that I'm feeling? Sometimes there's nothing to do except just feel it or experience, but sometimes maybe sharing what you're feeling with somebody else or doing something nice for yourself. What, if anything, do you wish for? Peace and a time machine. Maybe a time machine with a big peace sign on it, but you can only go back to Woodstock and smell people's BO. Have you shared these things with others? Yes, but my veteran affairs social worker got too busy with psychology to validate or empathize. That sucks. That sucks. Because it feels so good to feel validated or feel like somebody feels you. How do you feel after writing these things down? I wonder if I look as miserable as this survey makes me sound. You don't sound miserable. You sound like a sensitive person who experiences the overwhelming moments that life brings. And you are a war veteran on top of it. So I can't imagine. I can't imagine. Anything you'd like to share with someone who shares your thoughts or experiences? It's worth it to go and get help, even if you're a tough war veteran. And even if it is so, you can make an educated decision to give up your fight for life. That is a, you know, brutally honest survey. And that's one of the reasons why I created these surveys is, you know, we need a place where people don't sugarcoat it. You know, sometimes we're so afraid we're going to bum somebody out. And sometimes when I'm putting the surveys together, I'd be like, oh, no, that's too heavy. But, you know, I didn't start this podcast just to, you know, be entertaining. I started this because when I was in the depths of my depression and addictions, I felt so hopeless. And I thought I was the only one that felt that way. This is a happy moment filled out by Val, who identifies as gender fluid, and they write, when I leave the door open to my bathroom, or slightly ajar, my cat will come and sit by the opening and stare at me while I pee. It's nice to have the company. He will also, in the evenings when I'm stressed and studying late, start chasing his tail every night at least once, making me laugh and making it all better. Love it. I think I must laugh 40 times a day at just the shit Gracie does. Even if it's just cuddling in bed and just or the entitled look on her face. If I'm not scratching her in the right place, she'll start kicking her back legs like a rabbit, like trying to direct my hand where she wants to be petted, and I totally put up with it. This is from the Ask Paul Anything survey filled out by a woman who calls herself Criddle. She writes, looking for your perspective on a family issue, Paul. I have an 8-year-old nephew who is showing some mental illness signs, and the professionals around here seem to be of no help. He, along with my sister, his mother, and her two other children live with my mother. He's had recent violent outbursts towards my sister and family pets. He's saying he hears voices and does not have a human brain. My sister has called the crisis hotline, and they sent her to our local hospital, who dismissed them after a few hours there and said to call if something else happens. He's been on and off meds for 3 years now. I'm worried for my mother, sister, and my nephew's other two siblings. I know that he is young, but I don't know what could happen or what his issue might be. It's hard for me to hear these things and just be helpless towards this situation. I don't have room in my apartment to take anyone in, nor the funds. My question is, what would you do in this situation, Paul? What do you think is the best way to help? I am holding anger towards my sister for putting my mother in a dangerous and stressful situation. I also worry for my nephew. the type of hell he must be going through. I feel horrible for being angry and just feel useless. Any type of advice would be appreciated. First of all, I am so sorry that all of you are going through this, especially your nephew. And, you know, one of the hardest things to make peace with is our helplessness in dealing with other people's illnesses, especially when it's a nephew or a niece, and we just want to step in and run the show. But, you know, that, like I said earlier in the podcast, I think going to a support group like the National Alliance on Mental Illness, I think it would be a great place to maybe get advice or support from people with more knowledge than I would be able to pass on to you about what to do. But I know a part of that will be taking care of yourself and dealing with your feelings of guilt and helplessness and grief and anger. And I can say this, don't judge yourself for what you're feeling. It's that you are experiencing the price of being a sensitive human being in a chaotic world. This is from the love survey filled out by myself as a pumpkin. And they write, I love that my sister can make me full-heartedly belly laugh until my abdominal muscles are sore. I love that I can make her genuinely laugh hard with my silly drawings or jokes. I love how the day that I'm writing this was, and that I got to spend time with her and forgot all about the awful shit that's happened, about my suicide attempt and scars. I mean, isn't that life packed into two sentences? The sadness and the joy. And thinking that we can avoid either. Well, who the fuck would want to avoid joy? Idiot. Thinking that we can avoid the pain. This is a Shame and Secret survey filled out by a guy who calls himself Snowy Trees. He identifies as straight. He's in his 30s, was raised in a pretty dysfunctional environment. He's never been sexually abused, but he's been emotionally abused. He writes, I've recently realized that my mother used me as an emotional confidant for a long time, telling me things and displaying emotions I could not deal with at all as a young child. Any positive experiences with her? Yes, many. All things considered, my mom was excellent to me, especially considering her own childhood and life. I think it's great that you have compassion for her, and I just, anybody listening to this, or you, if you're listening to this, it is important to have compassion for other people, but not at the expense of compassion for ourselves. And it sounds like you are able to have compassion for yourself. Because a lot of people will say, well, my parent or such and such had a terrible childhood, so I should just get over this thing that happened to me. They're not mutually exclusive. You can feel sorry for someone's childhood, but not let that minimize what happened to you, because it keeps you from processing the feelings. Darkest thoughts. That there is a small, sad part of me that would love to throw my life away on weed and pornography. There is part of me that doesn't feel I know how to build relationships with anyone besides my wife now. I worry I will be unable to figure out how to find some self-worth in my life. Darkest secrets. When I was 9 or 10, I partially exposed myself to a younger cousin and a family friend on separate occasions. I feel immense shame and guilt that I have contributed to ruining their lives. I think it might be time for you to stop beating yourself up about that. You were fucking 9 or 10. Sexual fantasy is most powerful to you. Well, my dreams all surround porn and peep shows. My sex dreams aren't about sex with people. They're about buying porn or visiting peep shows. I'm embarrassed and ashamed about this. Sharing this makes me feel sad. What, if anything, would you like to say to someone you haven't been able to? I'd like to tell my younger cousin how sorry I am for partially exposing myself to him as a child. The worry, shame, and guilt that surrounds this eats away at me. That might be a good thing to talk about with a therapist and get their advice on whether you might approach your cousin and share that. What, if anything, do you wish for? To find some self-worth in my life so I can be a better person in other people's lives. To have a small community of people I am in close face-to-face relationships with. To have meaning and purpose in my life. To feel part of something bigger. That is so beautiful. And, I mean, you hit the nail on the head. To have meaning and purpose in my life. And to feel part of something bigger. That, speaking for myself, that has been the game changer for me. Have you shared these things with others? I've only shared it with my wife and therapist. I'm in my mid-30s in a new town and country and do not know how to make new friends. How do you feel after writing these things down? I don't know. Thank you for sharing all of that. And I hate to sound like a broken record, but you know, a support group might be a great place to make some new friends. Maybe even an online support group. There's tons of online Zoom meetings these days. I got an email from Karenique Hair that writes, "Want thicker, fuller hair, 65% off today only." And of course, I did. You know, when I saw this, I looked at my 35% head of hair and thought, that number just clicks. That just makes sense to me. And so I clicked on the link and flames shot out of my USB port and burned down the house to my left. Nobody was able to be identified, not even their dental remains. So I think that might have been a virus. But I was able to get a hold of one of their representatives and I said, I want thicker, fuller hair. Toot fucking sweet. I don't care what it takes. I gave them all of my credit cards, my bank account number, my social security, intimate pictures of me without a shirt, tastefully oiled up. And they said, you're going to have thicker, fuller hair within a week. And I was like, this is the greatest news I've ever heard. Well, it turns out that came in the form of a guy named Rick, who now lives with me. He's got a thick, thick, full head of hair. And I shouldn't have assumed that I would be the one with the thick head of hair. But I gotta say, just looking at Rick, especially when the sun is low, I almost feel like that's my head of hair that I'm looking at. I don't know if that makes any sense. And Rick, if you're listening, I did not mean to make you uncomfortable. This is from the Shame and Secret survey filled out by Soho. She identifies as straight. She's in her 20s, was raised in a stable and safe environment, and then says, being LOL and overly sheltered. Oh, boring LOL and overly sheltered. She was a victim of sexual abuse and never reported it. Sexual assault. I didn't even know it was sexual assault for years. I hated him and wanted the worst for him. He showed me his penis when I was 11 and told me to come back later. I never did. I was scared. She's been emotionally abused. Emotional abuse from parents and peers in school. My mother loved me and did her best, but in times of need, she wasn't emotionally available. She would always talk to me like a little adult and keep me close, so I had a hard time relating to other kids. Most of the times, I went unnoticed, but sometimes I was bullied. When I started standing up for myself, it got worse. Any positive experiences with abusers? Yes, because I knew my parents meant well. They will always be in my corner, but was on those cases, one of those cases, where the parents remember one thing, but I remember other things. I wrote a letter to my mother 1 year after I had long accepted she would never get it. Something about that letter struck her, and finally she saw my pain. I'm 27 now. I'm still uncomfortable being too close to her. It's over now, and I've given enough chances. But too many times, broken, depressed people have children and pass their baggage to their kids. Maybe we should start having an official ceremony when the luggage gets passed from one generation to the next. And do you accept the anxiety, the guilt, the catastrophizing? I do. I am uncomfortable being a friend to her now because she was never fully my mother when I needed her to be when I was hurting the most. But she's gotten much better. I'm also uncomfortable with children. I don't have much experience with them and they seem attracted to me, but they make me totally uncomfortable. Darkest thoughts. I empathize with shooters because I think that could have been me at some point. I don't make excuses for people that do that, but they didn't fall from the sky as fuck-ups. They have a history and stories that somehow people have brushed under the rug. I could never kill, but I've always had interest in mental health, and if someone cannot ignore what was uncomfortable to recognize and befriend some of these loners, maybe we wouldn't have as much devastation as we have. I think I read that right. Sometimes when people dictate, there are typos in here and it gets a little confusing. One of the biggest secrets that loners and weirdos keep, especially the ones that act like they're cool with everything, is that everything is wrong. Obviously, everything in everyone can't be fixed with a little therapy, but shit, it's worth a try. So true. You know, I hope one day we're able to look back at this era and see how much it is the dark ages of not only mental health, but physical health, the fact that we have a system that profits from people's sickness and we call ourselves the greatest country on earth. We fight wars to keep us safe, but when it comes to paying for somebody's cancer treatment, nope, you're on your own. Darkest secret, sexual assault, although I don't consider that a deep, dark secret, just something I don't tell. I'm not ashamed, though, just careful who I tell. Another thing I don't tell is that I'm not as spiritual as everyone thinks. I believe in God, but not as others think. I've dabbled in lots of New Age things. I own oracle cards, and I've gotten mind readings and psychic readings on men I've been interested in. That last one, the amount of money I've spent on psychics, might be a dark secret, LOL. I know things about them that they think I don't know. I also like gay porn. I won't be telling anyone about that. Sexual fantasy is most powerful to you. I'm 27 and never had sex. So I've thought about this a lot. Well, since I know what poverty is like, I'd love to be a financial dominatrix. I want to have sex, but at the same time, I'm not desperate or overwhelmingly interested. I just want to make someone pay me without the bullshit. I like the idea of having sex outside or someone watching me masturbate. I love dirty talk and stimulating other senses. I like creativity. Nothing too crazy. What, if anything, would you like to say to someone you haven't been able to? Nothing. I'm not dying to tell anyone anything like that. I'm open with conditions, just careful. And you know what? I think that's good. I think there's a fine line between shutting down and you know, just opening up to anyone and everyone and then finding out, some people are not safe to open up to. And in my experience, it takes time to get a sense of who is safe to open up to and to start off small, you know, and just kind of based on their reaction, decide, oh, do I want to share this other thing? What, if anything, do you wish for? A lot.
I love how vague that is.
I don't know, but I want a lot of it. Have you shared these things with others? Only online. I'd share if I felt comfortable with someone. No comfort, no share. How do you feel after writing these things down? Normal. Thank you for that. Let's see what else we got. And finally, we got an awfulsome moment filled out by a woman who calls herself Sexy Nun. She writes, the other day I was dealing with paralyzing anxiety and couldn't even leave my house. When this happens, it's usually because I fear I will embarrass myself in public. After struggling with this agoraphobic episode for hours, I finally called my husband and let him know how I was feeling. He suggested I walk to meet him on his way home from work, and then I'd have an excuse to get out of the house and a reward for leaving by being able to meet him outside. I took his advice and left the house to meet him on his way home. It helped get outside, away from my thoughts. When I met up with him, I felt instantly better and safe. He helped me as we walked back to our place, and I began to relax. We enjoyed the nice fall weather, the setting sun, and the window shopping on our way back. Our house is near a sex shop. I walk by it every day and have such a strong urge to go in and browse, but I usually tell myself to just keep walking because of my anxiety. I fear I will say or do something embarrassing, or that people will see me inside from the sidewalk and judge me for being there, etc. I also just feel weird about expressing my sexuality in general, which then leads to me talking myself out of going into the store. Blame it on my Catholic upbringing, my parents' slut-shaming, or my gender conditioning. On this particular day, we walked by the shop again, and my husband suggests that we go in and treat ourselves. Feeling good about my recent triumph to venture out and meet him, I agree. We went inside the shop, and I ended up finding an outfit I liked, a sexy nun ensemble, just in time for Halloween. We make the purchase, and I feel giddy about wearing the outfit at home. There's a church around the corner from our house in the sex shop. We live in a neighborhood that is historically a borough for Portuguese immigrants, but has since been gentrified. Still, some remnants of the original neighborhood are there. With a sexy outfit in hand, I exit the store, and I shit you not, I make eye contact with an old nun. Or what you thought was an old nun. Maybe it was somebody coming to return the costume. Or maybe it was an actual nun on her way to the sex shop to get an outfit of your clothes. That might have been the stupidest way to end a podcast. Maybe I'll make a top 10 list of the stupidest ways that I've ever ended an episode of the podcast. Oh, thank you guys for your surveys. And I hope you enjoyed today's episode. And if you are out there and you're struggling, never, ever, ever forget that you are not alone. And thanks for listening.
Everybody I know is bizarrely beautiful.
Everybody I know is
bizarrely beautifully fucked up in some weird way.
Bizarrely beautifully fucked up in some weird way.